feeling a little bored, need some outside activity, maybe you should take up hunting. If so, who would you want helping you, John Wilson or Quint? The perfect time for episode 19 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your We're Going to Need a Bigger Boat host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. I'm especially looking for more reviews on iTunes, and I'd love to know what you think. Today, my guest is writer and filmmaker Steve Weiss, who has chosen the Steven Spielberg game-changing summer blockbuster hit Jaws. Well, I have chosen the Clint Eastwood movie nobody has ever seen or heard of, White Hunter, Black Heart, both with stories about characters hunting down wild beasts. To begin, Steve, why don't you tell us something about yourself?
I am a screenwriter and a director, filmmaker. I have a short film called Survey that's been playing in the film festival circuit for 3 years now, winning awards internationally. I also have a screenplay that has done pretty well called Paradigm. It's racked up three awards so far. My big claim to fame is I co-wrote a screenplay for a Batman film that almost got produced.
Well, that's very exciting. It sounds like things are going along for you, and you've made some very solid achievements. That's great. Well, with that, let's get to your selection, Jaws. First, some information about the film. Jaws was released in 1975. It was directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Peter Benchley and Carl Gottlieb from the best-selling novel by Benchley. I also have to mention two more contributors here. It would be a crime not to include, and that is John Williams, who did the infamous music, and Werner Fields, one of the greatest editors of all time. It stars Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Lorraine Gary, Murray Hamilton, Peter Benchley in a cameo, and one of the authors, Carl Gottlieb, who apparently had to keep writing himself out of the script as the newspaper editor because he really had very little purpose of being in the story, apparently. The basic premise revolves around the small New England tourist town of Amity Island. Just at the beginning of tourist season, a young woman's body is discovered having been killed by a massive great white shark. As July 4th approaches, and when the town refuses to close down the beaches, a second person is attacked. The local sheriff, a marine biologist, and a professional shark hunter join forces to hunt down this ruthless killer. So why did you choose this film?
Well, Jaws is actually my favorite film of all time. I grew up watching it. You know, I was a kid when it came out. It gets better with age. The more you watch it, the more you can appreciate the filmmaking qualities in it, the acting, the writing, the directing. Everything came together beautifully. Funny story, one of the first film classes I ever took in college, we had to introduce ourselves and state what our favorite film was. Most of the students were listing off some artsy kind of films. When it came to me, I said, Jaws. Everybody in the room just gasped. How dare I list a blockbuster as my favorite film? But the thing is, this film really has it all. Just wonderful characters, primarily the theme of man versus nature. This whole Moby Dick thing going on, especially with Quint, where you have the hunter that's after the big fish, being obsessed with hunting it. Of course, that's one aspect of the film. I can watch this film and just appreciate it every time.
It has been called basically Moby Dick meets An Enemy of the People. An Enemy of the People is a play by Henrik Ibsen in which a local doctor at a very famous spa discovers that the water is becoming polluted and that they need to close down the spa, which would rob the town of a major source of money. It's the same basic principle here, closing down the beaches, which would cost the town a great deal of money. When did you first see the film?
I was probably about 11. I actually saw Jaws 2 first because I was too young when the first movie came out. They re-released the original Jaws in the theater before putting it on television. I was able to see it 6 times in the span of a 1 week in the theater. I fell in love with the film the first time I saw it.
Well, you've answered this to some degree, but what did you think of it upon seeing it again? What stood out for you this time?
Watching it again recently, the cinematography really is impressive. And I know, of course, there's the famous story behind making it where they shot pretty much everything on land and then moved out to the ocean. Production just came to a halt because the shark wouldn't work and they had all sorts of problems out shooting on the water. The production time tripled, if I'm not mistaken.
And I think it went 159 days over schedule.
Which is just insane. Having the cast and crew out on boats just sitting. A lot of times Spielberg would just have to roll camera on something. You just have to make up shots just to justify being out there for the day. somehow, and maybe Verna Fields is the credit for this, it came together amazingly well. You'd think that it was planned that way.
Another thing that she helped in this regard is because it was going so far over time, she was editing the first half. And because the dailies and the rushes and her editing job at the first half was looking so good, it helped the studio be more patient with Steven Spielberg going both over budget and also over time. But as they were filming during the day, then she would edit at night. And that contributed a lot to how well everything went in the end. I first saw it after it came out, probably because many issues, I think, but I was in college when I saw it. I might have looked down a little on it at that time because it is not an art film. It's a pop culture film that may have, since it's being made, or may sometime in the future cross over to art film status. But the more I saw it, the more and more I enjoyed it, and the more I realized just how good a film it is. I do think, as much as I enjoy it, there are certain things about it that I think you like more than I do. I think Steven Spielberg got better as a director as he went along. I don't think it looks particularly interesting.
Really?
Yes, I think it looks fairly standard for a 1970s movie. There's nothing that interesting in the way that most of it is shot, especially when they're out at sea. There's a reason, actually, why, and that's because Spielberg, to a great degree, had very little control over when he could shoot, what he could shoot, or what the parameters were. I think he even said that he thought he was going to be able to go out and just shoot this in a certain way and that he would have complete control over it. At one point early on, he was shooting things over and over again, and he finally realized, this isn't going to work that way. I'm not going to be able to shoot it like I want to. And I think, for example, that with Close Encounters looks far more interesting.
Just the way that he played with light and shadow in Close Encounters. Yeah, absolutely. But I still look at some of the shots. Quint at the front of the boat, where he's just resting back there with the sun setting behind him and the water bobbing up and down. It's a beautiful shot. And also some of the earlier scenes, my favorite is actually a dialogue scene. It's exposition, but it's when Chief Brody, the mayor, and the newspaper reporter and a few others are on the little ferry boat. It's done all in one shot. The camera's locked down at one end of the little boat, but the actors keep repositioning themselves. So even though the entire scene is done in one shot, it's a bunch of different shots that make up that one continuous shot. The staging of that is really nice. I love watching that.
That is an excellent little set piece, I guess you would call it. For me, the strongest aspects of the film are first the acting. I think it is incredibly well cast in the lead roles. At first, the studio wanted major stars, and Spielberg said, if you get major stars, they're going to distract from the story itself. You want actors that people have heard about. You want professional actors. You want people who know what they're doing. But you don't want Steve McQueen. And I think that was a very good choice. We have three excellent actors here giving excellent performances. Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and
Roy Scheider. Yeah, I believe that Spielberg initially wanted Sterling Hayden to play Quint.
But
he was unavailable, I think, for tax reasons.
So it was almost to the point of signing the contracts. The problem is that almost everything would go to the IRS, and Sterling Hayden would almost get nothing out of it. So in the end, it really wasn't worth his while. For some strange reason, Sterling Hayden could write books, and the books could be published in the U.S., and none of that would go to the IRS. But if he made a movie, then his salary would. And they said once he did a movie for TV and ended up only making $1 on it because everything else went to the IRS, I think he would have been wonderful in the role. Robert Shaw had his own income tax issues. He could only work in the U.S. for a certain amount of time before he owed the U.S. taxes. So he was constantly leaving the set to go to Canada and come back. And I think in the end, he had to pay taxes because it just went on for so long. And I think they took quite a bit out of his salary.
Him coming in at the last minute like that, did an amazing job.
I think he probably gives the best performance, as much as I like Richard Dreyfuss and then Roy Scheider.
Well, the thing, too, is that he's not in really a whole lot of the movie. He's introduced early in Act One, briefly, and then really about halfway through the movie is when his role really takes off. And, of course, once the three actors are out in sea, then it just becomes a collaboration between those three actors, and he dominates.
He does, though. Richard Dreyfuss does match him almost scene for scene. They disliked each other very much. They did not get along. Robert Shaw saw him as a young upstart Dreyfuss saw Shaw as this, oh, I'm so much better than you are because I do stage work. Richard Dreyfuss was getting very good reviews for a movie that did very badly and wasn't well reviewed, The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz.
Right.
And Shaw was kind of resentful of that or was jealous. And I think you can tell these two actors really don't like each other.
Played well for the contrast of the characters, though.
Yes. Because
that's what the dynamics between those two characters were. You know, and honestly, if you didn't have that antagonism, the scene with the three of them inside the boat at night when Quint tells the story of the Indianapolis, when the two characters kind of bond at that point, that's a really nice moment because you have that antagonism prior to it leading up to this point where it's like, hey, we've got something in common. It almost becomes them against Brody at that point because Brody's kind of the man left out.
You do sort of feel sorry for Brody at that point. He just doesn't have anything that these two people have. Though in the end, he's the one who ultimately saves the day.
Right.
I also, of course, love the music.
Oh, yes.
And the way it was used. I think it's just brilliant that you know when the shark is there and when it isn't based on the music. And instead of spoiling it, it actually made it much more suspenseful.
Well, and a good example of that is the scene at the beach where you have the two little kids with the fake fin.
Right.
And
he made me do it. He talked me into it.
But through that whole scene when the people are freaking out and panicking and running from the water up onto the shoreline, there's no music. Then the real shark shows up over in the body of water next door where Brody's son is at. That's when the music kicks in. And after that whole big scene with all the people panicking, and it's like, a little relief. And then you hear the music. Oh, no. It's for real now.
I think overall, as a movie, it's really exceptional. I think it is a really fine movie. It's a movie that doesn't do anything, but it just does it so extremely well that it rises above pop culture. It's a really exciting, a really good movie. You've named a couple of your favorite scenes. Do you have other favorite moments?
It's actually kind of funny. I'm going to bring up a scene that actually makes me laugh every time I see it because it's edited so awkwardly. I don't know what happened in the scene. They're examining the dead body of Chrissy, who was the first victim. They're in the morgue. There's a wide shot with Hooper's examining the remains. And then it cuts to a close-up of him lifting the arm up out of the pan. You just hear his voice say, this is what happens. And then it cuts back to the wide shot, and he's just continuing on with the little speech that he was giving. It obviously, they needed an edit for some reason.
Right.
And that was the only cutaway that they had, and they just dropped in some line. That's so jarring, but it cracks me up every time. As a filmmaker, I know what they did. I don't think most of the audience really pays attention.
That's also what happens when you see a movie, the number of times that you see it. I start noticing things about movies I've seen 6, 7, or 8 times, and I go, that is a weird edit, but they had to put something there for some reason that we don't know about. Those are very interesting to catch.
I really like the scene where the head comes out of the side of the boat also. I think that's done very suspensefully.
That always gets a big scream. Some of my favorite scenes are, of course, the one you've already mentioned, the monologue he has about the Indianapolis.
Yeah.
But I like two of the other scenes, the one where Quint crushes the beer can and Richard Dreyfuss crushes the styrofoam cup, or when they're comparing wounds and at the very end, he says, I have something that has you all beat, opens his shirt, points to his chest and says, so-and-so, she broke my heart. There are also a couple of nice edits at the beginning that I think most people point out. One is when Brody is on the beach. Someone passes before him and you're closer to his face, and someone passes before him and you're closer to his face again. Sort of tension editing.
Very Hitchcockian.
Yes. The other one is the famous one where he's sitting in the chair and it feels like he's coming closer to the camera, though actually the camera is probably going close to him when something happens in the sea.
That literally is taken from Hitchcock because of the effect that Hitchcock used in Vertigo. You're dialing in while zooming out or vice versa, depending on what effect you're trying to go for.
Even though this was in many ways a nightmare of a shoot because the shark didn't work, at the same time, as Spielberg said, the shark not working was in many ways a godsend.
Right. He said he had planned on showing the shark quite often. I think that the movie would not have worked if they had done that. And of course, a lot of people have talked about that, how the tension of not seeing the shark, they had to use the barrels. I think that was an invention while they were on the set. Shooting with the barrels, you see the barrels floating on the surface, you know the shark's right there. When the barrels go down into water, the shark's gone. Who knows where it is? I think that was a great way to create a lot of suspense and tension without a lot of special effects.
Yes, it's a technique that dates back to Val Lewton and Jacques Turner when they did films like Cat People, where they decided we're not going to show the actual cat or the leopard man, where they're not going to show the actual leopard because it was going to look cheesy. We'll just imply it. And what the audience imagines is probably going to be a lot more frightening than anything we could show. And as Spielberg said, this turned his movie from a Japanese monster flick into a Hitchcockian thriller. And it made all the difference.
This could have so easily just been a schlocky monster movie, basically. And you look at all these films that came after it that basically used the same formula, like Piranha or Orca, or even The Deep, which was based on another Benchley book. It's like, okay, we're capitalizing on the ocean or the water, but we're showing, in some cases, really badly done effects. And that's what you're kind of focusing on, as opposed to the storytelling and the suspense. I think that's where Jaws rises above everything else that came along after that, including the sequels.
In the end, it's the characters that people are going to be concerned about, not with the monster itself. It's not necessarily seeing the monster. Suggestion often works much, much better.
I mentioned this earlier as far as the themes in the movie. For one thing, we have Brody, who is trying to stop the monster. I mean, literally, that's his goal. Save his town, save his people. But then you have Wint, who, as we find out, his reasoning in his speech about the Indianapolis, he's on a quest that's completely personal.
Right.
You know, he wants to kill this thing because he has almost a personal vendetta against sharks. It becomes an obsession where he has to kill this thing, even if it kills him, which in the end it does.
I think originally they were going to have it where he was pulled into sea after he shot the shark. Mm-hmm. Something similar to what happened in Moby Dick, but they didn't go that way.
I think that's how he died in the book.
Right. The other change they made from the book was that Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss, the oceanographic expert, also dies in the book.
Yes.
As I understand it, one of the reasons why he doesn't in the movie, other than as I'm watching it, I'm going, you can't kill Hooper. It just doesn't make any dramatic sense, is that this movie all started filming long before it started filming down in Australia, when they had a second unit director down there filming sharks and filming someone in a shark cage, etc., like that. And it went very, very badly. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't get a lot of the shots they wanted. Finally had to call it off. They did get some shots, but they couldn't get the shots they needed where that character got killed. In the end, they decided, he's just going to have to live. We're just going to have to let him.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because you can see the scene where he was supposed to die. Instead, the character swims down and hides behind some rocks until everything's over.
Right. I'm out. It's all yours. I do have to say that no matter what you think of Jaws, it is, I think, one of the most important films ever made, at least when it comes to U.S. movie making.
Yes.
And it's probably the most important film ever made in the 1970s because it changed the way Hollywood made movies in two ways. First of all, it was such a success that Hollywood started gravitating away from letting directors direct, I'm not sure what you would call it, but independent art type films rather than studio type films, because Jaws just made so much money and it takes so much money to run a studio. These other films, which sometimes made money and sometimes didn't, just couldn't make the amount of money they needed to run the studio. They did try to keep some of that going by having a sort of independent sub-studio connected to them, but these films just could never make enough money to make it worthwhile. Jaws started taking the studios in a totally different direction. And because of that, we now have the rise of the independent movie makers that started in the 80s with Spike Lee and Tarantino and Soderbergh, the Coens. But the second thing it did, as I'm sure you know, because you know all about Jaws, is it changed the way movies, or at least summer blockbuster movies, were distributed.
Yes.
They were so desperate to make money off it, and they had to make that money as fast as possible. So instead of opening it on a smaller number of screens and then opening wider and wider and wider, they just four-walled the United States, opened it all over the country, all on the same day, hoping that that would help them make enough money back and it wouldn't matter about the critics. That's often why you did that. If they did that before with movies, it was because they wanted to avoid the critical reaction to a film.
Right.
In this case, they didn't have to because the critics pretty much raved or certainly didn't do it any damage. But because of that, that's often why summer blockbusters now open, and it just changed everything for better and for worse.
Yeah, and that gave rise to films like Star Wars that came just a couple years afterwards, cemented the whole blockbuster mentality. Yeah, prior to Jaws, it was just a different way of thinking about making movies and releasing them. It was a wake-up call, I think, to Hollywood, where they said, oh, we should do things this way. It's been like that ever since. Just gotten worse or better, depending on your perspective on how that philosophy has taken over.
No more Easy Riders, no more French Connections, no more Bullets, no more movies like that. It has to be something much, much bigger that's going to make them a lot of money, which of course today has led to the emphasis on franchises and remakes, rebooting by studios, as well as superhero movies, which are basically the modern day equivalents, whether people want to admit it or not, of Jaws, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, movies like this. It's no different. Basically, the studios are becoming great white sharks. And it takes a lot of food to keep that shark moving. So maybe in many ways, Jaws is a huge metaphor for the studio system.
That's pretty accurate, I think.
You do rank this so highly as your favorite film. Maybe speak more of that. What is it that really keeps it up there so high?
I like the sense of adventure. A lot of people list this as a horror film, and there is a certain horror aspect to it. Primarily, it's an adventure. And I think that's what drew Spielberg to the story to begin with. You have these three guys going out to sea to hunt this unseen killer. They have to work together, and in some cases, fighting amongst each other in order to meet this goal. I'm drawn to adventure stories. I think that that really, in a kind of a realistic manner, unlike the Indiana Jones movies, which I love, but those are more fantasy adventures, where this one is kind of grounded in reality. That's the main draw that I have for that.
Well, I certainly think a lot of that reality goes back to the book, which was incredibly well researched. In fact, as I understand it, in many ways, Steven Spielberg threw out the first part of the book and said, we're going to more or less start from scratch and creating characters and dialogue, and a lot of changes were made. But when it came to the shark hunt, that pretty much stuck to the book. They did change the ending, how the shark died, to make it bigger.
More cinematic.
If the shark didn't die this way in that big a manner, I probably would have been let down. It would have been too anticlimactic.
And I know that eventually later, because of the effects that the movie had on the general public, where it became almost like a hatred of sharks, and people were going out hunting sharks to the point to where, I don't know if it was the great white or some others that were almost to the point of extinction. And he had to basically create a nonprofit or whatever, really trying to educate people about sharks, that they're not necessarily just these evil killing machines. They actually serve a purpose in the environment.
And this was also a very important film, of course, for Steven Spielberg. I think his career could have gone so different very easily. His first feature film, Sugarland Express, hadn't been released yet. And in many ways, he was being hired based on some television work as well as Duel, the made-for-TV movie that was a huge hit and which was released in movie theaters in Europe. But Sugarland Express was not a success. I like the movie very much. People don't seem to. And I do wonder if that movie had been released before Steven Spielberg had been assigned to Jaws, whether he would have been assigned to Jaws.
I don't think so. I think that he probably would have ended up back with more TV movies or shooting more television episodes. Of course, it was the same producers, Zanuck Brown, who did The Sugarland Express and Jaws. He came across the book because David Brown, one of the producers, his wife was Helen Gurley Brown, who was a publisher. He always had access to books early before they actually hit the market. So he had a copy of the book sitting on his desk, and Spielberg, so the story goes, saw it and asked to read it. And he came back and said, I want to direct it. Book had not even been released yet before Spielberg was signed on to it. The book may not have been a hit. Just so many ifs that could have happened along that domino effect.
That was one of the worries they had. What they were worried about is they knew it was going to take so long to make the movie. That the book was only a moderate hit, that wasn't going to help either. But fortunately for them, it stayed on the New York Times bestsellers list in hardback form for 20-something weeks. And then after that, it goes to Book of the Month Club, things like that. And then it hits paperback. That just gave it this huge shelf life. But of course, it put a lot of pressure on them, because what if the movie didn't live up to the book? They were going to be making a lot of changes. What if people didn't like that? No one seemed to care about the changes, which makes me suspect that nobody was reading the book for its literary quality in the first place.
Probably true. I honestly didn't really care for the book. It's okay, but there were just so many things, like Hooper had an affair with Brody's wife, and there was like some subplot with gangsters. You know, let's just get to the show.
But with that, here's some more information about the movie. It cost $9 million to make. It made $470 million that year. It got 4 Oscar nominations. It won 3. It won for Best Score, Film Editing, and Sound. It was nominated for Picture. It did not get a nomination for Director. That probably went that year to Fellini's Armacord. I can't really argue with Fellini getting a nomination over Spielberg, but that was the year of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and this is a totally different discussion. I'm not a big fan of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so I would have had Spielberg over Milos Forman. Peter Benchley himself appears as a reporter about halfway through. Gottlieb was hired because he was a comedy writer. He had been working on the TV series The Odd Couple. They felt that they needed some comedy in this movie or it just wasn't going to work. Susan Blackley plays the first victim of the shark who gets attacked while skinny dipping. She then satirizes this by skinny dipping in Spielberg's movie 1941, where she goes into the Pacific Ocean. Suddenly, she gets hoisted up by a German submarine. The shark was named Bruce, and it was named after Spielberg's lawyer, Bruce Raymer. And apparently, as someone said on my last podcast in Finding Nemo, there's a massive shark there named Bruce, named after the shark in Jaws.
Yeah. Another little bit of trivia, Carl Gottlieb and Richard Dreyfuss shared an apartment together when they were in college, along with Rob Reiner. So when Carl Gottlieb was brought on board, they were trying to get Richard Dreyfuss because he had just come off of The Apprentice, Judy Kravitz, getting some, you know, these rave reviews for this. He was just like, nah, I'm not going to do this shark movie. Spielberg had Carl Gottlieb reach out to him, and it was Gottlieb who convinced him to come on and do the film.
Is there anything else you might want to add about the film before we move on?
Of course, it spawned 3 sequels that diminished in quality greatly. That was another effect that it had, was spawning sequels. It also created a sequelitis that we have to throw a number 2 on it, a number 3. I think Hollywood changed because of that also.
With that, let's get to my selection, and that is White Hunter, Black Heart. First, some information about the film. White Hunter, Black Heart was released in 1990. It was directed by Clint Eastwood and written by Peter Vertell, James Bridges, and Burt Kennedy, based on a book by Vertell. It stars Clint Eastwood, Jeff Fahey, Alan Armstrong, George Janza, Charlotte Cornwell, Norma Lumsden, Marisa Berenson, Richard Vanston, Timothy Spall, and Clive Mantell. It also has Jamie Coss. She almost has no lines, but I feel like I should mention her because she's basically playing Lauren Bacall. Most of the characters in this film are based on real people. The basic premise of the film is inspired by real-life director John Huston as he arrives in Africa before starting up to shoot the classic adventure romance, The African Queen. Before the director begins the movie, he wants to shoot a great elephant, but his prioritizing the hunting of the beast and the moral quandary of shooting such a magnificent animal leads to tragedy. So to begin, what do you think about the pairing of these two movies?
Thematically, they tie in together because with the character of Quint in particular from Jaws, he is this hunter that is obsessed with getting this animal, the great white. The Clint Eastwood character, John Wilson, who's a film director, his obsession is hunting an elephant, another huge beast that, you know, out in the wild. The difference, though, is in Jaws, the shark is the villain, whereas in White Hunter, Black Heart, the elephants are innocent. He's wanting to shoot this just because he's a hunter. He just wants to go out and do big game hunting. He agreed to do this movie in Africa so he could go out and do the safari and hunt what he considers the biggest beast and take it down. In both cases, you have this obsession that ends up leading to death. On one hand, it's his own character's death, but in this one, it's the death of another character that dies tragically, like you said.
When did you first see the film?
Just a couple days ago, as a matter of fact. It's a movie that I've had on my list for a very long time, actually since it came out. I actually remember Siskel and Ebert reviewing it. They gave it positive reviews, if I remember correctly. And the one thing that they talked about was how Clint Eastwood was essentially doing John Huston. Clint Eastwood is an actor that you normally just associate with very low-key characters, not a lot of dialogue, squinting a lot, glaring at people, growling. In the case of this character, John Wilson, he talks a lot. He takes on John Huston's demeanor, his speech pattern, the way he carries himself. He becomes John Huston. And it's actually quite an amazing thing. I've appreciated Clint Eastwood as an actor and a director for a lot of years, but I wanted to watch this movie simply for his performance.
And what did you think of the movie overall?
I liked it. I was very engaged with it. Of course, you know, being a filmmaker, I always enjoy watching movies about the process of making movies. Even though this is a fictionalized account of the making, or the pre-production, I should say, of The African Queen, it still was kind of interesting seeing that inside view of Hollywood, the interaction between the director and the producer, the screenwriter, and to some degree the actors, and being on location. Kind of got a kick out of the fact that they were on location. It starts raining, and they just had to throw the schedule out the window, because that almost happened to me on a film.
And similar things happened in the making of Jaws, where the weather and the way things happened got in the way of filming itself. I first saw the movie when it came out. First, I suppose I might say that I am sort of an outlier when it comes to Clint Eastwood. I enjoy his movies. I like watching them. I don't think he's a very good actor at all. I think he's perhaps better than Charlton Heston. He may be as good as John Wayne, but what is fascinating about Clint Eastwood as a movie actor is the characters he plays. He tends to often make two kinds of films. He makes the Dirty Harry type films, which sort of glorifies this tough man, he-man, white man, a type of persona, me against the world, and I'm the only one that can save things, etc. And the other kind of films that take that same persona and sort of question it, right, like Play Misty for Me. I think that he's also just an average director. I've never understood why people think he's a particularly good director. That has always mystified me.
I think that he comes from being an actor and who became a director. There's a certain class of directors that I would lump Rob Reiner and Ron Howard into, that to where they're coming from an actor's point of view, not necessarily from a cinematic point of view. I noticed that watching this film, too, the shots are very basic. There's a lot of wide angles, a lot of medium shots, not a whole lot of creative flair when it comes to camera work. There's a few times where it's like, oh, okay, he's trying something different there. For the most part, it's just pointing the camera at the actors and letting the actors do their thing. Like Rob Reiner once said, and I'm going to mangle the quote, essentially he was saying his job was to put the camera where it would best serve the audience. So the audience has the best seat in the house. Which is kind of true. You look at his films too. They don't have a lot of flair, but you're engaged because you're watching the actors. I think a lot of actors turned directors kind of fall into that realm. Unlike the auteurs that come out and they're wanting to dazzle you with the camera angles and the editing and the shots.
I think that's very insightful. Even films like Mystic River, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, his most recent films like The Sniper, the camera work is all very standard, very basic.
Yeah.
And I also understand he doesn't like to do many takes. There's not really necessarily a lot there. But for me, this movie is not only, I think, his best film, I think it's quite possible his masterpiece. I think it's his greatest performance.
I agree with you that this is probably his best performance.
But I almost want to say it's actually his only performance. Perhaps. The reason why I think why he gives such a great performance, and this happens to a lot of actors who in many ways just sort of play themselves or play a persona. If you give them something where they cannot be themselves, you give them an accent, give them a real person to play that they have to imitate. Sometimes you just give them facial hair. And suddenly they free themselves and they can give a performance with a lot more depth and a lot more interest. So here we have Clint Eastwood imitating John Huston and doing an incredible job of imitating John Huston. There are times when you almost wonder whether this is actually John Huston or not, because I think Clint Eastwood captured him so well.
Yeah, there were a few shots, especially some wide shots of Clint Eastwood walking, and just his whole body language was John Huston. And I had the same reaction. Wow, that's like watching John Huston on screen, not watching Clint Eastwood. It's just completely different demeanor.
Right. He couldn't play himself. He couldn't be the character that he normally is. I'm not sure this ever really happened much in any other movie. The closest I think he ever got was the recent movie The Mule. He also isn't playing Clint Eastwood in this movie. He's playing a rather average man who in many ways reminded me of my father in his demeanor and his personality. I also thought that the film looks much better than many of his films, and it's more interesting to look at. And again, he's doing a period piece, doing something that's not about himself or about the persona he usually plays. From a looks perspective, it may not quite reach Letters from Iwo Jima, but it's almost up there. And I think Iwo Jima is probably his best piece of direction.
See, I still think Unforgiven is really high up there, too. I think that's an amazing piece of work that he did. Talking about his acting, there's two different kinds of movie stars, if you will. There's the personality, the Arnold Schwarzeneggers or the Stallones or people like that, who basically are the same person in every film. It's just a variation of that same on-screen person. Tom Cruise is like that for the most part. And then you have character actors, Daniel Day-Lewis's and Gary Oldman's to some degree. De Niro used to be like that before he became a personality. And Clint Eastwood is a personality. Go to see a Clint Eastwood movie because you expect Clint Eastwood to be Clint Eastwood. He's very effective at that, and he's very charismatic, but he's generally that same type of personality from film after film. It could be a comedy, it could be a Western, it could be a war movie. And even in this film, to some degree, he kind of plays off that macho image, but twists around to be John Huston. It's such a fun performance. I just got such a kick out of watching him have fun with this role.
I was getting a kick out of it too, not just because he was having so much fun with this role, but the character was a lot of fun. And I'm going, he's actually acting. He's actually giving a performance. And I was kind of taken aback by that. And I wish he had continued on with that instead of going back to making the same kind of movies that he had been making before this. But of course, we'll get into that later. But the movie didn't do very well.
My understanding is he did the movie The Rookie with Charlie Sheen about the same time period in order to do this film.
Right.
Like, okay. Let's do the studio buddy cop movie.
Yeah, it's a one-off. Yeah.
He actually shut down production for a week to be able to go to the premiere of this. He didn't care about The Rookie. He cared about this film.
What are some of your favorite moments or scenes from the film?
Talking about getting a kick out of his performance, I appreciated the opening, not the opening scene per se, but his character introduction. I'm a big fan of character introductions. If a movie can really do it right, I'm really happy. Following the Jeff Fahey character as he enters this mansion and goes up the stairs and enters the room, and you see this shape of a person sitting on the bed reading a newspaper. The newspaper drops down, and there's Clint Eastwood. This big grin comes over his face, and he hops out of the bed fully clothed, is just like this ball of energy. He's like, look at my outfit. Do you like this? You like what I'm wearing? And it was hysterical. And that was the moment where it's like, okay, we're not watching Clint Eastwood do Clint Eastwood. We're watching him do something different.
Right. I think perhaps my favorite scene is the hotel scene, where the ending of it is the fight.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's an extremely well-written scene. And it's another place where it sort of goes against Clint Eastwood himself, or to the persona he usually plays. For one thing, the character he usually plays tends to be rather conservative, not exactly right-wing. Everybody often calls Dirty Harry fascist, but I said, no, he's not. He's someone who always threatens to break the law or violate the Constitution, but he never does, which is why he gets away with what he does. But now he's playing someone with a totally different, in many ways, political outlook, because John Huston was a liberal for his time. But it also ends with this fight scene where, for the very first time, Clint Eastwood plays a character that is defeated in a fair fight.
Yeah.
He always would either win the fight or people ganged up on him so that there was more than one person fighting him to take him down. Or in one movie, he threw a fight. But this was the only film where he played someone where someone beat him in a fair fight. The actor Clive Mantell. Clint Eastwood was older than he was. Mantell was in pretty good shape. Apparently Clive Mantell had a very difficult time keeping up with Clint Eastwood in that fight scene.
That whole sequence was just brilliant. The scene before the fight scene, because it really kind of was a 1-2 punch, if you will, because you had the John Wilson character talking with essentially the stand-in for Katharine Hepburn. She really comes out with a lot of anti-Semitic views, which are kind of shocking.
I have to correct you there. No, that's not Katharine Hepburn. That's just some woman staying at the hotel. Katharine Hepburn is played by Marissa Berenson. She and Humphrey Bogart haven't even arrived yet.
That character expresses these anti-Semitic views. He basically gives this long speech, which in some respects is on par with Quint's speech from Jaws.
Right.
That you have this character that is talking about something that happened in the past, and kind of his insight into his character. At that point, you understand who he is and what's motivating him. But moving on from basically telling off this woman who is anti-Semitic to then dealing with someone who is showing cruelty to the African workers there in the hotel, to the point where he's like physically beating them. It's like, okay, that's the character in a nutshell right there, that he is willing to fight and stand up for the underdog.
But that does sort of eventually then lead to some irony. So it's here we can talk about how you felt about the ending.
I was, through the whole movie, hoping that he did not shoot an elephant. I was really dreading the moment where he actually killed an elephant and then had to deal with the ramifications. It surprised me in a little way that it was his African helper that did not speak English, and so they had to deal with either going through a translator or just kind of a form of sign language to communicate. The John Wilson character brought him in under his wing, if you will, looked at him as here's someone that he really respected. When facing off of the elephant that it was getting ready to charge, the African character jumped in and basically saved John Wilson's life, but was gored by the elephant and was killed. In some respects, it was okay, that's kind of convenient. I don't know if that happened in real life or not. Dramatically, it makes sense with the theme of the movie and where it finally, John Wilson had to deal with what his obsession was, that his obsession got someone killed. I actually loved the ending where they come back to the village where they're shooting, had to communicate to the villagers that he died. The translation of what they were saying was White Hunter Black Heart. He's someone that is fighting for the underdog, showing that he's not a racist, not a bigot, but yet because of his actions, the villagers consider him having a black heart. And then he's having to return to work and basically for the first shot of the movie, just saying action. That kind of affected me.
I think there is an irony here that, yes, he fights for the underdog. He's a liberal. He supposedly has no racism. But in the end, he is a white person that exploits these black characters as well. Just because he has good intentions in his heart, he still doesn't really understand what is really going on with these people. And he's still willing to treat them in some way, to some degree, the same way that the other people are who look down on them.
Right.
He considers them rather childlike and considers them something for him to impress, and I'm your big white savior, and he's not their white savior, and he kind of realizes that at the end.
He kind of treats everybody like that. Everybody is beneath him, whether it's his friend Peter, who he brings on board to rewrite the script, or the producers, or the other people that work on the film. Even though he may be a liberal, and he may look at people who are oppressed as this ideology, as opposed to real human beings, but the real human beings in his life, he does not treat very well.
I suppose we should mention, of course, who the people are that these people are really playing. And of course, Clint Eastwood as John Wilson is playing John Huston. Jeff Fahey as Pete Verrell is playing Paul Bertel, who was an up-and-coming novelist when he began writing for movies and did very well. So he's always considered being a novelist was what he really wanted more to be. George Zunza as Paul Landers is playing Sam Spiegel. Marisa Berenson as Kay Gibson is Katharine Hepburn. Richard Vanstone as Phil Duncan is playing Humphrey Bogart. As I said, then Jamie Coss, who is with Humphrey Bogart as Mrs. Bogart, then has to be playing Lauren Bacall, and Lauren Bacall did go on location with him, though I don't know if he's based on a real person or not. I just have to say Timothy Spall as the bush pilot is absolutely wonderful. He's one of Mitch Lee's regular set of actors that he uses in his film, and he's just a wonderful, wonderful actor. And he's
the scene where he's flying the plane and it's going all over the place is really fun.
And then reveals, oh well, that was just a joke that John Wilson wanted me to do. With that, here's some more information about the film. It cost $24 million to make, and it made $2 million. It was a flop. I do remember that it came and went. And, you know, as I said before, a lot of people don't know anything about this film, even Clint Eastwood fans. And I think it is his best piece. Paul Bertel introduced surfing to Europe while working on another film, The Sun Also Rises, when he was in Biarritz. Paul Bertel was a big surfer. He diverged from his intellectual family to a certain degree in that way while they were off with all the intelligentsia in Los Angeles as refugees from Europe. He was off surfing, and he started the very first surfing club in Europe. His second wife was Deborah Carr. They stayed married until her death, and then he died 2 years later. The boat in the movie was the same boat that was used in The African Queen. And the gun Clint Eastwood used in the film was also the same gun John Huston had when he was making the film. This is both James Bridges and Paul Bertel's last movie as screenwriters. People might recognize Marisa Berenson from her roles in Cabaret and Barry Lyndon. So with that, is there anything else you might want to add about the movie or the other movie or both movies together?
One thing that I noticed, a technique that this film uses, that thinking about Moby Dick actually, is the, I don't know what the literary device is called, but basically we're seeing the events of the film play out through the eyes of a secondary character. In this case, Pete Farrell.
There is a term for it. It's third person something.
But it's basically, he's Ishmael. He's the character that's telling the story, literally, because the real person, Peter Hertel, wrote the book that this movie is based on, and he co-wrote the screenplay. That character literally is telling the story. We're seeing all the events through his eyes, even though he's not the main character. Dr. Watson is to Sherlock Holmes.
That's a device that's more used in books than movies. Every once in a while, I keep trying to figure out any movies that uses it, and usually I only come up with movies adapted from books. The other major one is Nick Carraway and The Great Gatsby.
I think it was very effective.
To a certain degree, it theoretically gives you an objective viewpoint, though at the same time, of course, the person telling the story is shading events to his own interpretation of. With that, let's start closing out, and I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
I mentioned this film before, kind of as a knock against it. Joe Dante's Piranha is a complete ripoff of Jaws, but
I think it was actually purposely made at the time as Roger Corman, we need a ripoff of Jaws.
Exactly.
And I think John Sayles is one of the writers who contributed to the script.
He was. It's really a fun movie. It's a cheesy little low budget, not no budget type of film, but it has a wit to it. It makes fun of itself and the tropes. If you're into Jaws ripoffs, I would highly recommend that.
Do you really want your Roger Corman films to be anything other than cheesy with a lot of wit?
Talking about John Sayles, you got Alligator also, you know, from the same time period, where you have another aquatic beast that is on the loose killing people, and it's a cheesy, really fun film.
That's why you watch Roger Corman films. For me, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm actually going to recommend a film I have not seen. It's a film I've always wanted to see, but for whatever reason, I just never gotten around to see it. And it's called Track of the Cat. It's from the 50s, I believe. I didn't write down the date. It's directed by William Wellman, and it stars Robert Mitchum and Teresa Wright. And it's about two ranchers, brothers, who go hunting for a leopard that is killing their sheep. So it basically has the same premise in many ways of Jaws. Also, because this is a movie about a movie, I could not let it go by without mentioning the greatest movie about making movies. And that is, of course, Day for Night by Francois Truffaut.
And, of course, we can't forget to mention The African Queen, which is movie essentially that is being made in this film, although I think it's called The African Traitor.
Oh, yeah, like that's going to fool anybody. What is next? What should we be looking for, expecting from you? You did mention your film.
It's called Survey. And we've been shown internationally about 50 some film festivals. I kind of lost count. The film has earned 18 awards so far.
Can it be seen anywhere, or is it still playing at film festivals?
Right now, it's not available to the public, but it will be going on Amazon pretty soon. In the meantime, I'm trying to develop Paradigm, which is the feature film that's won a few awards. Got a producer on board. We're looking for funding at the moment. It's a wonderful phase called development.
As for me, I'll go through my usual litany. I am a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Howard Kastner screenplay consultation page on Facebook. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning screenplays and screenwriting and movies. I have two books of short stories that I published on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, fantasy, and horror short stories. The second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, is also available on Amazon. And I am an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram.
If you are interested in checking out the Batman script that I co-wrote, it is available on Amazon, Batman Dark Knight, all one word, DARKNIGHT. I also have a collection of short stories called Portals of Mind that's on Amazon.
Great. The previous podcast was with Drew of Drew's Movie Reviews, and we talked about the films Finding Nemo and The Searchers, both films about children being abducted. The next podcast will be with screenwriter Jordan Trippier, where we will discuss the movies Constantine and The Wailing, two films about demons. With that, Steve, I very much want to thank you once again for being a guest on my podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. This was fun.